This podcast is a recording of the session The Moment We Are In, Kicking Capitalism When It's Down, which was held at the Cork Grassroots Gathering in November 2008 in Cork. You'll find more recordings like this at www.wsm.ie.
I'm doing a fair bit of recycling here. Anybody who has watched the video online, this is a slide from, don't panic, it's not going to be 90 minutes long, just what the video is. But it's a couple of useful quotes in terms of the idea of capitalism being down. The first was an anonymous head of equities of a large UK bank to the Financial Times about 3 months back, who said, "It feels as if we are 15 minutes away from the end of the world." The second one is the ever-popular George W. Bush, who observed that if money isn't loosened up, this sucker could go down. Now, I'm kind of odd because, for a couple of reasons, you know the way people of a certain age knew where they were when Elvis was shot? You probably heard that one, or when JFK was shot. I actually know where I was when I realised the Celtic Tiger was real. And that was 1996, and I was in southern Spain, actually, at the time, at an international meeting, and I just got talking to some Italians in the street, and they were asking me about this Celtic Tiger thing, and I was sort of saying, nah, it's a load of nonsense, it's all kind of fake, you know, it's all this kind of funny trading stuff, there's no real economic boom. And I was halfway through saying this, which was very kind of rhetorical and common for the left at the time, when I realised I was actually speaking complete nonsense. And went away and thought about it for a while. And the other thing, I also kind of know where I was when I realised that this economic crash was going to be really big. And that was basically the 29th of April this year, just after I flew into Miami. So that's why the picture's there behind me. That's me flying into Miami. Miami had this huge property boom. Right? In the US, it was the area that had the biggest property boom of anywhere. Rents had been shooting up. The guy I was staying with was actually working as an organizer in trailer parks because the rent income of trailer parks had dropped way below the property prices, so people were being evicted in order to be able to build condos basically on them. But the crash had arrived at that point in Miami, and what had happened was that there'd been a huge amount of building of high-rise luxury apartment blocks, and these things had been going up month after month. They'd reached 10 or 15 stories. The crash had arrived, the banks weren't putting money forward anymore to enable the building to go on, and it had just stopped. And all over the city, there were just, you know, and I'm sure it's pretty much still the case there, there were all these kind of 15-story things that were meant to be 25 stories, and there was no construction happening, and there hadn't been any for a couple of months. I was doing a speaking tour, and it kind of moved from there up to a few different places. Detroit, which was once the heart of industry in the U.S., you know, kind of car manufacturing stuff, and is now a city that's actually in ruins. It actually looks like it's been bombed, you know, like maybe this is some place there was a war like 2 months back and grass is growing a little bit, but things have been blown up. The population of the city area has dropped from about 2.5 million in 1974 to about 750,000 today. So most houses are derelict. There's kind of factory complexes that run 10 blocks by 4 blocks, and it's all completely derelict. I've loaded pictures of that, but I won't run through lots of them. And then another place I ended up in a bit later was Minneapolis. Now, Minneapolis is interesting because a couple of years ago, there was a big bridge collapse there. The Mississippi runs through Minneapolis at rush hour, and there were a load of people killed because the cars went into the river. And that was basically part of an underfunding crisis in infrastructure that was happening. People knew the bridges were dodgy, but there wasn't any money to fix them up. When I was there, what had happened was the school kids were going to school in three shifts because there wasn't enough money to run all the school bus fleets at the same time. So what they'd done is they were sending the kids in at 9, you know, 8, 9 and 10. In order to be able to use the buses. And, you know, this was the US, which I previously had this impression of as being this incredibly wealthy economy, you know, everybody's kind of loaded. And, you know, there was all this sort of stuff going on. It used to be pretty much the case that, you know, things like the market will heal itself, or the less government intervention in the market, the better. Were things you heard on the radio all the time, you know, constantly repeated. Sort of the dogmas of neoliberalism. And the current apocalypse and finance has pretty much consigned these to the dustbin. But I think we need to look behind the media spectacle of crashing banks and panicking stock market traders and get some sort of understanding of the real causes and meaning of the current crisis. Now, I'm not an economist. I don't do much reading in economics. But fortunately, a couple of other WSM members spent a lot of time looking into this, and I've partly ripped off some of the stuff they've come up with. We've put videos online that are the long version. I'll go into it in great detail. I'm only going to talk for a couple of minutes, literally. Politicians and economists, if anyone's following this, are fighting over whether this crisis is one of liquidity or one of solvency. You know, is the problem that it's just cash flow, the money isn't moving around fast enough, or is the problem that there just isn't the cash to actually cover things? And I think what we need to be saying is, to a certain extent, it's both, and to a certain extent, it's neither. From our perspective, what it really is a crisis of globalization and of distribution within globalization. Neoliberalism in the last 20 years, globalization, whatever you want to call it, allowed capitalists to outflank Western workers, the power people had over production, because there was a huge relocation of production to the Far East, in the case of Detroit to Mexico, and also the anti-union states of the American South. And part of that process was the creation of a global financial system that escaped the powers of nation states to regulate them. You know, the reason the City of London became this huge financial sector was because it was a way of American banks to move foreign currency around outside of the control of the American government. That was basically what the deal was there. That new system in turn formed the basis of a huge shadow banking system. I'll talk about what that is in a second. And the currently collapsing pyramid of unsecured debt was built on this system. That's why it's a crisis of globalization. People have probably heard some of the jargon of this, things like credit default swaps, right? And I'm not going to go into what those are because it would take too long. But basically what happens, and part of the reason we've had this crash, is the need to parcel up risk. With globalization, it used to be if you were running a company and you were sourcing all your products and all your workers locally, you knew how those other companies were getting on. You probably weren't going to be caught by surprise if one of them went out of business. With globalization, you're suddenly dealing with companies all over the world who you've no contact with whatsoever. One of them goes bang, your production comes to a halt. So one of the things that was needed was a way to bet against that happening. And that's what a lot of the kind of risk trading was actually involved in. It's why it's actually, you know, it's not a case of kind of greedy bankers messing stuff up or stupid policy. This was actually quite central to how the system has worked. Cheap finance, you know, the fact that you could borrow money for at low interest rates was a central part of the system. It's not some sort of incidental thing. The property crash was only part of that. Credit for workers has been part of the foundation of consumer capitalism since about the 1920s. It's not new in itself. But what happened under neoliberalism in the Western world from the mid-70s is in most cases workers' real wages actually fell. Particularly true of the United States, where there's a massive decline in the real, you know, if you take inflation into account, the actual earning power of most workers has declined drastically over that period. Now, what happened instead was that credit became much more available. It was much easier to buy stuff, and the kind of gap that would have opened in consumption, you know, the fact that we wouldn't have been able to buy stuff was put off because instead you were able to borrow money, and that built up. And again, it's not, you know, it's not incidental, it's not bad policy, it's actually a central way of the system has been working. And what's happened now in the crisis of the banking system is a breakdown of what's called the wholesale money market. Banks basically get their money from two sources. One is retail deposits. That's people like you and me who go into Bank of Ireland and maybe, you know, our wages go in there every month and then we take them out bit by bit, right? And that's part of the money the banks are lending out. That's what that is, right? And the other part, and in fact it's the bigger part of it, is what you call, it's what's referred to as shadow banking. And that's the banking of the rich, right? It's things like hedge funds that people talk about, right? Because rich people don't put their money in, you know, the corner bank. They, you know, you don't make enough money from the corner bank, they're not interested in that. That's why all those hedge funds and those investment products existed. That was a way for them to make vast amounts of money. And what happened at the start of the crisis is the rich took their money out of that system. So, for instance, in the US, when they talk about this $700 billion bailout, right, one of the interesting things that happened, if you look at the figures, is that within about 2 weeks of that bailout happening, the top 1% of American society took about $700 billion out of the banking system. So, effectively, American taxpayers put $700 billion in, the people who were making the money out of it and realized the money wasn't there to be made anymore pulled that money out again. Again, it's all part of how the system works, in other words. It's not, you know, bad bankers, it's not greedy bankers. This is how things were meant to work. Without our intervention, what's going to happen in the coming period is that capitalism is going to transform itself. It's going through this crisis, there's all sorts of stuff happening already, and a lot of what's happening is about trying to make us pay for this crisis. So, you know, we've seen stuff like the pensioners' demonstrations, the Dublin student demonstrations, there's all the talk at the moment on the radio about targeting public sector workers. Right, what that's all about is saying, okay, system's in a mess, Richard pulled our money out of it, so we need some way of putting more money into it. And what we do there is we go after ordinary working people. We go after people on a weekly wage and a weekly salary, and we make them pay for it. There's resistance to it at the moment, right? But the way they intend to overcome that is through unemployment. Unemployment's growing massively. It's growing massively in lots of countries. And that's going to sweep away spontaneous resistance over time. People who were active during the 1980s will remember the kind of way people were so demoralised during a period of mass unemployment, the fear it brought in people. You know, people just didn't see any options. It wasn't a period of mass resistance for the most extent. But right now, that hasn't happened yet. And I think this is kind of quite important to understand. Right now, there's an opportunity. And I mean, that opportunity is happening spontaneously in terms of the numbers that have been coming out for the demonstrations that have been happening in the last few weeks. You know, it's very obviously people are willing to fight back. That's not something that's necessarily going to last. But we have a period of months, maybe a year or so, in which there's a possibility of building resistance on a scale we haven't seen in this country for, you know, a generation at least.
Thank you, Andrew. I suppose that's quite a lot coming down. So
I've got to apologise for standing up. When I was a young player in school, I was in a debating society, and we were, this is how we were taught to speak publicly. I can't be sitting down. It makes it look a bit hierarchical. You forgive me. It's a small thing, I suppose. I'm going to start with the story. Ray alluded to me being an activist for a long time, and I have grey hair, far younger as it is, and I have been an activist since I was 16. But not all of it spent in doing good activism. And I was remembering the other day, because, you know, when you're 40, you start thinking about life. And I was remembering, when I was quite young, I was involved in a lot of campaigns in the city, and I was in quite a Leninist hierarchical organisation. And I remember going to meetings, and there used to be two guys there, Kevin Doyle and Don Lodrisco. Some of you know them, Cork people. They were the two Cork anarchists at the time, as it happened, that I was familiar with. And every time the campaign would get organised, of course, they'd be along because the issues were important. And they'd always advocate that the campaign was organised democratically and there'd be no committee, we'd have collective meetings to take collective decisions. And they were always poo-pooed and they laughed on a bit, and then we'd set up our committee and they'd go in a room and organise and lead us, and that was all grand and well. I was only reflecting now that if you went to a meeting in Cork and suggested setting a committee and putting them in a room, you'd be lynched. And that's a remark of how far things have come on. So what's the opportunity? Andrew's looked at the opportunity that arises currently. Well, the current crisis, quite frankly, is quite deep in terms of the economics and that, but the ideological crisis is very deep as well. The neoliberal project we've all been fighting against in our various campaigns on, is completely discredited. It is completely discredited. Capitalism had this idea, they sold it, they convinced the people to this idea. People who criticised the capitalism really laughed because, you know, of course it works. We're all getting people, you know, the houses being built. All that was accepted. And now there's a crisis of ideas. And they're trying to sell, they're trying to sell a new idea to us, you know. The idea could be the far right, the fascists are trying to sell their ideas to people in various countries. The social democrats are always saying, look, just elect us to government and we'll manipulate this, manipulate that, and we'll deliver for you. I mean, that's part of Obama's thing, is people are crying out for alternative ideas. So that's where that gap exists, someone will try and fill it. And the system will try and fill it with people that maintain the system. Okay? Now, it's in our interest, obviously, to destroy the system, destroy capitalism, and replace it with something better. And I'm an anarchist. I want to see an anarchist society, and I think a lot of people here are anarchists or libertarians, and we want to see that sort of society built. And this affords us an opportunity, a rare opportunity, because... Not as long lived as everybody in this room, but long enough lived to remember the 80s that Andrew said that was kind of at the very start of the 80s, there was kind of opportunity, there was an upswell of people protesting and defending their jobs and fighting against unemployment and stuff. But that period passed, and capitalism triumphed and secured itself, and then the neoliberal project came along to be the next wave, if you like. So who would have thought that we'd see New Labour nationalising banks in Britain? or the neoconservatives pumping money, regulating the banks in the States. You know, everything ideologically they've argued against, they've had to turn back on. So that hunger for ideas that we were talking about earlier exists in the population too. Now, how can I say this with conviction? Well, if any of you remember now, any point in your life is when you talked about politics and ideas and alternative ways of viewing the world as much, I'd be glad to hear it. Because never in my life have I experienced as much of hunger for ideas and talking about what the alternative is. And recently there was a radio program, you remember Joe the Plumber in the US elections, you'd be familiar with this ad nauseum. But RT went and they interviewed several Joe the Plumbers in the States. There's seven of them on the net selling themselves as Joe the Plumber. And what was inspiring was one of them, they're all asked who they'd vote for, and one of them said, well, you know, I don't really believe in the system at the moment. I couldn't be bothered. And I thought it was quite inspiring to hear someone in the mainstream radio say, basically, capitalism doesn't work. Should I vote in the elections? It's not going to make any difference to me. And another thing was an elderly woman on Joe Duffy's show. Even though I forget the woman's name, she's an actress in Fair City. And I've heard, and I'm very thankful for that. They'll always have the answer. She was on Liveland and she phoned into Joe Duffy, really angry about the medical care being removed. And Joe Duffy went, what would you suggest? Well, I'm suggesting an anarchist solution, she said. We should take those forms to the cross and we should all burn them. We should all refuse to participate. And it was interesting just to hear on mainstream radio someone. Obviously, a Joe Soap arguing for anarchism. You know, we need a bit of anarchism here. So, at no point, I'd say in any of your lives, has been easy to walk up and say, look, capitalism is fucked. Everyone's saying capitalism is fucked. What's the alternative? You know, there's no alternative. But now we can actually say, well, you know, anarchism, you know. And instead of people, taking off those streets, they'll actually listen to you now. Well, some of them will listen to you. But the point is, how often does that come around? That an idea, just a bald idea can be thrown at you and you'll listen to it and hear it out and you say, well, you know, we give it a bit of credibility, but because people are really worried, they're losing their homes, they're losing their jobs, they look around the world, it's all the same, and they're looking for an alternative idea. And this is our opportunity, if you like. So like things like the pensioners, who talk to the principle of universality, when did you hear that before? When did you hear 17, 18-year-old women on the radio arguing for the principle of universality? Within a week of that campaign starting, the principle of universality was in common currency all throughout this country. That idea that everyone, every pensioner, should have a medical card. I never heard that argued for before. I never heard the principle of universality ever mentioned on radio before. But within the space of a week, that idea caught on. And everyone was singing off the same hymn sheet. The principle of universality for children, a medical card. Everyone accepts that now. You know, it's mainstream. All of a sudden, these ideas are mainstream. They're mainstream currency. Before it would be, well, we can't afford it, or, you know, people should have to pay. But this is the point I'm making, is that ideas can catch on very fast if people are out arguing for them. So how best do we do that? Well, in every context that we're active, because we're active in lots of different campaigns, and we're often active in very different spheres. You know, some of us are students. I'm long gone from being a student for a year. But students are arguing, education is a right, not a privilege. There you are. That's consistent with anarchist idea. Everyone should have access to education. You shouldn't have to pay for access. Teachers are out there fighting, not for extra wages or for better terms and conditions. They're arguing for more teachers so that children have smaller class sizes, so that the children will get a better education. We all agree with that. It's easy enough to argue that. So what's the difference in terms of what we're arguing for now and what most people are arguing for? Because you can link up all this thing, the idea that everyone should have access to Medicare, everyone should have housing, everyone should have a full stomach, everyone should have a roof over their heads, everyone should have a job. What's the difference between us arguing for that and any union arguing for, any campaign arguing for that? Well, the difference is how we get it and how we keep it. So the important thing for us in campaigns we're involved in now is that we've got to start arguing for the ideas and the structures of the type of society that we want to see. In other words, every campaign's got to reflect that. We've got to start training ourselves and working with other people so we have that vision of the new society in every campaign we're involved in and every group we're involved in. So how do we do that? Well, it's easy enough to throw out there as an idea, but it requires organisation, obviously. And I was very inspired to speak. Several people here were at the speaker, Oscar from Bolivia. A few of you there definitely at the meeting, and he was talking about the water wars in Copacabana. And what was great about his was the spontaneous uprising of people, but their level of organisation, because they had to organise, but they were losing their right to water. So what happened was there were democratic assemblies of people. As this campaign built up, the natural instincts of people were to go for very democratic structures, democratic assemblies, blockading the streets collectively, constant discourse. And it was a bottom-up struggle that didn't have a hierarchy, that had a rotating, if you like, a delegate structure. People could be recalled from it. Very positive, very inspiring. And he said what was disappointing, though, is they defeated this transnational corporation, they defeated the army and the police and the state and the whole lot. And what happened next? Well, he said what happened next was they elected Evo Morales in the back of that wave of enthusiasm. And now they have another president. And the state still exists, and the army and the police. And a certain amount of people can co-opt the system. And the structure that imposed the thing first day remains in place. It's a bit softer. It's not as vicious, but the structure is still there, and the movement, he said, had been disempowered to a certain extent. The momentum had gone out to a certain extent, and a layer of people had to take within the system and had abdicated their participation. So what can change? How can that change? So he said the big question for them now is how to get back that energy, how to get back that idea that people taking decisions from the bottom up. And they've identified the idea. Well, you know, the state is a bit of the problem as well, isn't it? It's not just about who's in charge of the state, but it's actually the state itself, because it continues to reinforce the structure. So in Bolivia, you know, many of them are talking about people involved in the social movement. This man had used the ministry on the grounds that power must come from the people, up, not from the government down. That they're talking about how we create a new society that doesn't involve people having power over us. And we know what that is. We know that's anarchism. And we know that we're going to go out and argue for that. We argue for that all the time amongst our friends, maybe in smaller groups. But at the moment, it's a chord that can be touched amongst a lot of people, layers and layers of people. And you need people out there arguing for those ideas within every campaign in order that when the opportunity arises, when people are on the streets, when people are confident enough and have the experience enough and have the hunger enough, that we can transform our society. So this little window of opportunity that's been created by the current crisis creates that little opportunity where we get the ideas out there and maybe start the ball rolling in a particular direction. So what have we been offered? Well, look at some of the structures that we face. Today I read in the paper that CIPTU had voted to accept the partnership agreement. You know, at the time of greatest opportunity, capitalism is weakest, the government is broken, or one of our leading trade unions decides we'll just do a deal with them, you know, instead of we struggle and fight. So we need to be, if you're in your union, you need to be networking with other union members. You need to be fighting for democracy. You need to be fighting against the ideas that say we accept things passively, or that we just leave it to the guys up in the head office there to make decisions for us. If you're in your colleges, you need to be organising with fellow students. You need to be arguing again for taking on the defeat, refusing to accept the system. If you're a pensioner, well, the pensioners have done their job, haven't they? They're inspiration to us. So in our communities, everything that you're involved in now, you've got to argue for those structures. And I want to talk about a few things that are quite inspiring. There are a lot of organisations, a lot of groups around the country now. But I was up in Galway recently at the new centre up there, the social space. And what's really good about the social space? Well, it's practicing the new society. It's an extremely democratic and open structure. Everyone participates in the society. And it's a living example of what we want our society to look like. And the grassroots is a living example of how we want to interact as equals. Here we're not, there's no stage here. we're interacting as equals, so everyone's ideas are as valid. And we can bounce the ideas around, but the most important thing, the key thing to us having success, is being organised. Being organised, because organisation helps us maintain continuity, helps us maintain continuity of ideas, so the ideas are passed on to generation and the memory of everything that we've done before. If we weren't talking about the grassroots getting, we're trying to write down the list a while ago. Who's going to remember that if this movement is defeated next year and it fades away? Organisation is very important for us. So get organised, you know. You might want to join the WSM, of course, I have to send the WSM as my job. But you might be joining the RAG. You might be involved in the social space in Galway. You know, you'll pick the place where you can make your best impact. And you'll network with other people and you'll organise. and put out the propaganda and get involved in the campaigns. And I argue that the key things are direct democracy and direct action for us. That's the way we've achieved things in the past. That's the way we get things in the future. And when people practice that, people practice it enough, it's like an old instinct. It comes back straight away. Every time you're confronted with something, yeah, that's what worked last time, you go out and you do it again. And one of the most inspiring things about being on that pension was American Patrick Street was walking along the march. I mean, all these people, I was kind of shocked that I knew so many that you guys had a world. All these people who've been involved in campaigns previously, and the instinct was there. When they attack us, we get out and fight. And the last thing I want to say is that actually, we're actually at war. And it's a war that flares up and goes down over time. But we're at war now in the sense that in the 80s, they put us to the ropes and they really hurt us. A lot of people's lives were destroyed in the 80s in that recession. It was a really nasty recession. And they'll try and do the same. They'll try and make the poor and the workers and the old and the sick pay for this recession. The same as they did the last time. We'll be the ones put to the ropes. It's okay if you're single and you're young. It mightn't affect you as much. But if you've got kids, or if you're elderly, or if you're sick, you'll be the ones made pay for this. So we have an obligation to defend ourselves, but also all those people in our society will be persecuted as well as this. And we can do that by being organised. And the class war is always waged by them. It must always be waged by us if we want to succeed. Thank you.
You've been listening to a recording of The Moment We Are In, Kicking Capitalism When It's Down, a session recorded at the Cork Grassroots Gathering in November 2008. For more audio and also video recordings, go to www.wsm.ie. In particular, you might want to check out the longer videos on the economic crash that were mentioned at the start of the first talk.